Well, welcome. Good afternoon. Hope you all are well. We tried to provide some good weather, which is rare this time of year, but we're pretty thankful for it. My name is Matt Overton, and I'm the associate pastor here for Youth and Families. Our head of staff, Fitz, sends his best wishes. He's off doing a wedding in North Carolina this weekend for a former student of ours. So he's off enjoying, well, I don't know whether he's enjoying in this weather that side of the country or not, but you're stuck with me. So we welcome you to our church. We're glad you're here. We always say, you know, during Sunday mornings and other times, we hope this is a place that feels welcoming to you, where you can catch your breath and feel a sense of God's comfort and peace as you're here, and just feel God's hospitality. A couple of reminders before we get started and welcome Father Boyle. One, the restrooms, we had a few people ask us about that. It's pretty essential. If you go out the doors there and just go to the right, there's a couple restrooms there. If afterwards it's done, if those are a little bit crowded, you can go right down the stairs there. There's some in the lower hallway. And there are a couple, like, really backup emergency ones straight down the children's wing, straight down there. So I can't guarantee you the size of those restrooms. Second, if you'll just make sure your ringers are off or quieted, silent, something like that now. I always forget that, so I thought that would be a helpful reminder to you all. A couple of people have asked about kind of the format for today. And basically, Father Boyle will be speaking for about an hour, and then we have some questions that he'll be answering as well. And he and I kind of sit up here. I was trying to decide the best way to do that, and I think I solicited questions online from some different people, and we thought that would be the fastest and easiest way to kind of get that done. So we won't be taking questions from the floor, in case you were wondering about that. And the last thing is Father Boyle will be preaching here in the morning at both our services at 9 and 10:30. I have no idea what will happen if all of you showed up. But it might be a wonderful, terrible problem to have. But if you wanted to join us, we would love to have you. And those are at 9 and 10:30. Our 9 o'clock is our usually more full one. It's our more traditional one. And our 10:30 is contemporary. It's pretty low-key, though. So just so you're aware of that. Great. I will keep this introduction brief. I've never done an introduction before, so this is pretty exciting for me, actually. But I don't think Father Boyle needs a lot of introduction. 2 years ago, when we were doing some alternative forms of ministry, someone sent me a link to a TED Talk for Father Boyle, and I didn't know anything about him. But in watching 20 minutes of that, I was captivated by the story of the ministry and by the way, and became very interested. And then at some point along said, hey, what if we could get Father Boyle to come here? And sure enough, here we are. But Greg Boyle is the founder of Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles, California, in case you don't know much about him. It's the largest gang intervention, rehabilitation, and reentry program in the world. He's a Jesuit priest, and from 1986 to 1992, Father Boyle served as the pastor of the Dolores Mission Church, then the poorest Catholic church in Los Angeles that also had the highest concentration of gang activity in the city of Los Angeles. Father Boyle witnessed the impact of gang violence in the community there during that time, and he and his community members adopted what was then a radical approach at the time, which was to treat gang members as human beings. In 1988, they started what would eventually become Homeboy Industries, which employs and trains former gang members in a range of social enterprises, as well as provides critical services to thousands of men and women who walk through the doors every day of the year seeking a better life. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Tattoos on the Heart, The Power of Boundless Compassion, and his new book, Barking to the Choir, which we have no more copies of in the gathering area now. Well done, all of you. His new book, Barking to the Choir, The Power of Radical Kinship, was published in 2017, just about a month, maybe a month or two ago, it kind of came out. He received a number of awards for his work from the Catholic Church and various other organizations around the United States, but he's here today to get to share with us, and it's a wonderful opportunity, so I know you're thankful and excited as I am. So let's welcome Father Greg Boyle.
This is good? Okay, yeah. Good. Thank you. It's good to be here with you. I think I was supposed to be here last year, but one of the homies was killed who worked at Homeboy, so I had to delay my arrival here. You know, talk about good weather. You know, it's 80 degrees in Los Angeles. Yesterday I was in Chicago. It was zero, and they were talking about that as being balmy. So I'm wearing everything I own. so I'm still kind of a wuss. So it's a privilege to be here with you, and I love this part of the country. And it's a privilege of my life for over 30 years to have worked with gang members, and the day won't ever come where I have more courage or I am more noble or I'm closer to God than the thousands of men and women I've been so privileged to know. People like Louis Perez, who I write about him a little bit in the book. He was kind of a force of nature. Knew him since he was a kid, and gang member, kind of a shot caller, heroin addict, and he kind of ran Homeboy for a time. But then he also was very much in demand as a speaker. He would go out to schools, and then people would ask for him. They'd send us that guy, Louis. And he and I were having dinner once, and he was giving me tips on how to speak publicly. He said, you know, you have to pepper your talk with self-defecating humor. And I said, yeah, no shit. That's some good advice there. So brace yourselves. I have a suspicion that one of the reasons you're here, well, really has little to do with me. It has to do with you. It has to do with a longing to somehow to imagine the world looking differently than it currently looks. Mother Teresa diagnosed the world's ills correctly when she suggested that the problem in the world is that we've just forgotten that we belong to each other, especially now. We've forgotten, and so how do we stand against forgetting that? How do we imagine a circle of compassion and then imagine nobody standing outside of it? How do we together give in to that longing, which is God's dream come true, that we create a community of kinship such that God, in fact, might recognize it? How do we together dismantle the barriers that exclude? And so we've come, I think, all of us, to this understanding that in order to do that, we have to situate ourselves at the margins. So if you stand at the margins and then you look under your feet, you will discover that the margins are getting erased precisely because you chose to stand there. And you stand with a kind of particularity with the poor and the powerless and the voiceless. And you stand with those whose dignity has been denied. And you stand with those whose burdens are more than they can bear. And every once in a while, I suspect everyone in this room has had that exquisite privilege to be able to stand with the easily despised and the readily left out, with the demonized, so that the demonizing will stop. And with the disposable, so that the day will come when we stop throwing people away. So I suspect if kinship happened to be our goal, we would no longer be promoting justice, we'd be celebrating it. And we go to the margins and we can already feel ourselves bracing ourselves because people will accuse us of wasting our time. But the prophet Jeremiah writes, in this place of which you say it is a waste, there will be heard again the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voices of those who sing. And you go to the margins and suddenly other voices get heard. Of course, none of this makes any sense unless we kind of examine what kind of God we have. You know, I think there's the God we actually have, and then there's the God we've settled for. There are a lot of signs and indicators that kind of illuminate for us the God we actually have. I'll give one example. You remember when Dylann Roof went into the church, Mother Emanuel Church, and killed all those people. And it was something like a week later relatives of the victims were standing in front of him face to face, and they said, "We forgive you." And everyone on the planet knew we were in the presence of the God we actually have. But then 9 months later, when a jury sentenced him to die and called it God's justice, everybody knew we had reverted back to the God we've settled for, the partial God, the lesser God, the more realistic God. St. Ignatius of Loyola, I'm a Jesuit, so I quote him occasionally, and he talks about the God who's always greater. So just when you think you've landed on it, you want to arrive at this Christ consciousness of this spacious, expansive, always greater God. And the homies are always kind of illuminating this for me in ways that I think might be even surprising to them, but are quite constant for me. And they usually do it by way of mangling the English language. They're kind of the Yogi Berra of East Side gang members. And so they're always mangling the English language. In fact, the title, Barking to the Choir, which my publisher hated and didn't want me to use, comes from a homie who was a baker in our homeboy bakery. And he was kind of attitudinal and having a bad day and bad weeks and months and late and missing and kind of belligerent to the supervisor. And so I'm running it down to him, and he's standing in front of my desk, and he says, "Relax, you're barking to the choir." which is a combo burger of barking up the wrong tree and preaching to the choir. And I said, "That's the title of my book," He didn't think it would sell books. I think if I could get Donald Trump to denounce it, it would probably... How do you do that, I wonder? So the homies are always kind of mangling the English language. So I had a homegirl named Lisa, who one of our trainees. We have about 300 plus trainees in our 18-month training program. And at the end of the day, her man came to pick her up, and so she wanted to introduce him to me. And so she, two of them standing in front of my desk, and she says, "This is my sufficient other." I said, "No doubt." Homeboy is now quite large. If you've ever been to our headquarters, and as Matt mentioned, it's the largest gang intervention rehab reentry program on the planet. So it's $19 million annual budget, and so we have 9 social enterprises, and it's huge. And it's not what it was when I started it. I have a CEO who kind of runs the place, which is nice, so I don't have to worry about cash flow and will we meet. I still worry about meeting payroll, but he does the day-to-day stuff. And so I had a homie come into my office, and he said, "Damn, gee, my lady, she is in a bad mood today." And I said, "Why?" "Well, she's beginning her administration period." And I said, "Well, I've just ended mine, so kind of know what she's going through." But my favorite one, it has something to do with our topic at hand. It happened when I was presiding at a mass, and I'm in all these detention facilities on a rotating basis every Saturday and Sunday. And so that's my church at the moment for the last 30 years. So I was at San Fernando Juvenile Hall, and about 500 kids, mainly gang members, mainly males. I don't think there were any females there then. And so I'm vested. I have my alb and my stole, and they have this little sheet that has the readings of the day in English and in Spanish. And so I have it resting on my lap, and I thought, well, how you do when you preside. Sometimes you close your eyes, and I'm going to listen to the word proclaimed. And so the homies were coming up and doing the readings, and a homie got up and was doing a psalm. And with kind of an overabundance of confidence, he got up and he said, "The Lord is exhausted." And I looked at the sheet, what the hell? And of course it said, the Lord is exalted. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, that's way better. That's the God we actually have. You know, because the exalted God, truth be told, is kind of a creation of ours, created in our own image. Anne Lamott says, you know you've created God in your own image when God hates the same people you do. But the exhausted God is this kind of expansive, spacious, extensive God, too busy loving to have any time left to be disappointed. The God who loves us without measure and without regret. That is a better God than the one we have. Or the one we've settled for anyway. So we're called to create a community of kinship such that God might recognize it, because that is God's dream come true. And we somehow want to align our hearts with that same desire. And so, you know, the homies have taught me so much about that over the years. But they've really taught me in the last few years how to text. And I'm so grateful to them, because I find it sure beats the heck out of actually talking to people. And I'm pretty good at it, and LOL and OMG and BTW. And the homies have taught me a new one, OHN, which apparently stands for, oh, hell no. And I've been using that one quite a bit lately. I know I can't be alone in being vexed by this autocorrect thing, you know. And I had a homegirl named Bertha. She's a tough cookie. And she texts me on a Sunday, where are you at? And I said, I'm about to speak to a room full of monjas. And monjas is Spanish for nuns, sisters. I'm about to speak to a room full of monjas. And I pushed send. Autocorrect told her I was about to speak to a room full of ninjas. Which she thought was pretty darn interesting. Even right now, I try to keep up. I get thousands of text messages. And the homies, always their hair is on fire. And, you know, they have to pay this bill, or they're going to cut off the lights. And once a homie wrote me and said, you know, I need $100 to finish off my rent. I didn't have it. So I wrote him back, things are tight. I pushed send. Autocorrect told him, thongs are tight. He wrote me back, sorry to hear that. You know, what about my rent? So there I am in a car with two older homies, older vatos, Manuel and Poncho, and they do a variety of things at Homeboy. And I said, come with me. We're going to give a talk at a high school. You can get up and speak. And so Manuel's in the front seat, and Poncho's in the back seat. Older guys with tattoos and been to prison and everything. And we're 15 minutes on the road when Manuel gets an incoming text, and he reads it to himself, and he chuckles. And I said, what is it? Oh, it's dumb. It's from Snoopy back at the office. Well, I'd just seen Snoopy before we left as the day began. He gave me a big abrazo. And Snoopy and Manuel work together in the clock-in room where they clock in hundreds and hundreds of gang members, all our workers. It's a tough job. I wouldn't want it because gang members, this may come as a surprise, can occasionally be attitudinal. So I said, well, what's he say? Oh, it's dumb. Hang on a second. Let me see here. Oh, here it is. Hey, dog, it's me, Snoops. Yeah, they got my ass locked up at county jail. They're charging me with being the ugliest vato in America. You have to come down right now, show them they got the wrong guy. Well, the three of us, we exploded. I almost drove into oncoming traffic. We laughed so damn hard. And then I realized that Manuel and Snoopy are enemies. They're from rival gangs. They used to shoot bullets at each other. Now they shoot text messages. And there's a word for that, and the word is kinship. How do we obliterate once and for all the illusion that we are separate, that there is an us and a them? Even everybody in this room, and including your kids, are engaged in some kind of service, and obviously that's a good thing. But service is where you begin, it where you end. Service is the hallway that gets you to the ballroom. But you want to get to the ballroom, which is the place of exquisite mutuality. At Homeboy Industries, I'm not the great healer, and that gang member over there is in need of my exquisite healing. The truth be told, we're all a cry for help. We're all in need of healing. And we have to be careful even with service, because there can be a distance there. You know, service provider, service recipient. You want to bridge even that distance. I remember a homie, a former gang member at Houston, who was currently what we would call in the biz a hardcore gang intervention worker. So he's out in the streets and stuff. And he was pleading with me. He says, how do you reach them? And I said, gang members. And I said, for starters, stop trying to reach them. Can you be reached by them? Can you receive who they are? Can you value them enough so that they will have this extraordinarily new experience to find themselves valued and cherished? Can you be reached by them? Even the expression, make a difference, we use this all the time. But I don't think we go to the margins to make a difference. We go to the margins so that the folks at the margins make us different. Because if it's about fixing and rescuing and saving and making a difference, how is this not about me? And it's not supposed to be about me. And so how do we arrive at this exquisite mutuality where there is no distance, no daylight that separates us? So no homie in our history found more job opportunities endlessly than this kid we all called Dreamer. I knew him since he was a little knucklehead kid growing up in the housing projects. He got into a gang. Older brothers also from the same gang. One of the smartest kids I think I've ever known, although I don't recall that he ever actually went to school. But really quick and with a dangerous sense of humor, which I always enjoyed. But he's in his 40s now and has a home and wife and kids and a good job. But in his early 20s, he was kind of a yo-yo, in and out of being locked up. He'd come to Homeboy and I'd find him a job either in the private sector or in one of our businesses. But always before too long, he'd always gravitate back to vague criminality, usually something involving drugs, the sale of or the use of. And then he'd wander back to me. So this was a pattern that kept repeating itself. So this one time he had finished a four-month stretch, probation violation, county jail, and there he is sitting in front of my desk. And he says what gang members often say, this time it'll be different. And I went, all right. So with him sitting there, I picked up the phone. I called a friend of mine named Gary who runs a vending machine company in Alhambra, California. And Gary had hired homies in the past against hope. Maybe he'll do it again. And so sure enough, he says, you tell that guy he can start tomorrow. That's a holy man right there. So Dreamer began work the next day at the vending machine company. Well, 2 weeks later, there he is again, sitting in front of my desk. I just couldn't even believe it. I said, Híjole Madre Santa, here we go all over again. But this time he reaches into his pocket and he pulls out his very first paycheck. And he says, damn, gee, this paycheck makes me feel proper. I mean, my mom, she's proud of me, and my kids, they're not ashamed of me. And you know who I have to thank for this job. And I said, well, gosh. Who? And he looked at me strangely, and he said, well, God, of course. I said, oh, sure. No, that's right. That would be God. You thought I was going to say you. I said, no, gosh, God's number one. He said, you are so lucky we're not living in them Genesis days. I'm sorry. And he said, yeah, because God would have been had struck down your ass already by now, you know. Well, I guess he told me. But I defy you to identify exactly who's the service provider and who's the service recipient. It's mutual, because you can tell it's starting to go out. The passing of the torch and the obtaining of a new battery. One of the great privileges of my life was knowing Cesar Chavez as a friend. And he was the best listener I've ever been in the presence of. If you were talking with him, nobody else existed. He was laser beam focused. He was hanging on every word. He was never looking over your shoulder to see if someone more important was on the approach. But once famously, a reporter had commented to him and said, wow, these farm workers, they sure love you. And Cesar shrugged and smiled and said, the feeling's mutual. And that's the hope. That's God's dream come true. You don't go to the margins to make a difference. You go there hoping against hope that the folks at the margins will make you different. And there's a reason for that. In the original covenantal relationship, God says, as I have loved you, so must you have a special preferential love for the widow and the orphan and the stranger. And God identifies these subgroupings of the poor, because God thinks these are the folks who know what it's like to have been cut off. And because they have suffered in this particular way, God thinks these are the folks who are trustworthy guides to lead the rest of us to the kinship of God. And that's the hope. They go before us. They're guides. We don't go to the margins to fix or save or rescue the widow, orphan, and the stranger. But go figure, we all go to the margins. Everyone finds rescue. So as Matt mentioned, Homeboy was born a long time ago when I was pastor of the poorest parish in the city, nestled in the middle of two public housing projects, the largest grouping of public housing west of the Mississippi. We had eight gangs at war with each other, which was really unheard of, making it, according to the LAPD, the place of the highest concentration of gang activity in the world was my parish. I didn't know this when I arrived. So there are 1,100 gangs in LA County and 120,000 gang members. So the first thing we did, while I was burying kids, that was sort of the first thing that happened. I buried my first young person killed because of this sadness in 1988. I buried my 222nd 2 months ago. Not all from that community, but I know a lot of gang members. I get asked to do this. So the first thing we did was we started a school because there were so many junior high, middle school age gang members who had been given the boot from their home school. Nobody wanted them, so they were wreaking havoc in the projects, selling drugs, violent. So I walked out to them and I'd kind of isolate them. I'd walk one away and I'd say, hey, if I found a school that would take you, would you go? And to my surprise, every single one said, yeah, you know, I would. And then I couldn't find a school that would take them, you know. So that kind of forced my hand. And so right across the street from the church is our elementary school, our parochial school, Dolores Mission School. First two floors, the school. But the entire third floor was the convent where the ninjas lived. And so I gather all the nuns together in the living room on the third floor, and I said, hey, you know, would you guys mind, you know, moving out? And we could turn the the convent into a school for gang members. And so they looked at each other and they said, sure. Like that. That was the extent of their discernment process. And so this brought gang members in large numbers to the church, not to services, but to our property, which created kind of something of a disconnect. You know, people in the parish started to say, wait a minute, wait, aren't churches supposed to be hermetically sealed? You know, good people in and the bad people out. And I thought, wow, that's a great gospel challenge. And so gang members before too long started to say, hey, you know, if only we had jobs. It was as simple as that. And so myself and the women in the parish, we marched around the factories that surrounded the housing projects trying to find felony-friendly employers, and that wasn't so forthcoming. So we started things. We started crews, you know, a maintenance crew, landscaping crew, graffiti removal crew, a crew to build our child care center, all made up of rivals from the eight gangs, which was very tense. And then in 1992, after the Rodney King verdict, the whole city of Los Angeles exploded, April 30th or something, and 1992. And every pocket of poverty just ignited, except my parish. And so the LA Times wanted to know why that was. Perhaps the most likely community to ignite didn't. And so I said, well, I think it's because we had 60 strategically hired gang members who had a reason to get up in the morning and a reason not to gangbang the night before, and more to the point, a reason not to torch their own community. So the very next day, a movie producer named Ray Stark read this in the paper, and he summoned me, and he happened to have $500 million. And he said, how should I use my money? And now that I look back on it, I see that I woefully undershot my request. I said, well, why don't you buy this abandoned bakery across the street from the school? It's got ovens. We could put hair nets on rival enemy gang members. They could bake bread. I don't know. We could call it Homeboy Bakery. That was the extent of my business plan. And he said, sure. And we were off and running. So a month later, we started Homeboy Tortillas in the Grand Central Market. Once we had plural, we changed our name, which was originally called Jobs for Our Future, to Homeboy Industries, as if there was any industry involved in this. Not everything worked. I'll be the very first person to admit it. Homeboy Plumbing really was not hugely successful. Who knew? People didn't want gang members in their homes. I did not see that coming. And now you never intend to do something like this, but you back your way into stuff all the time. And so now we're the largest such place on the planet. So 15,000 folks a year walk through our doors trying to catch the crumb that falls from the table. The centerpiece, of course, is our 18-month training program, which kind of models a little bit. You know, if a baby is born and it's like 18 months to really attach to the caregivers. And we kind of model that in the 18 months, acknowledging that attachment repair is always possible, because every gang member who walks through our doors comes to us with what psychologists would call a disorganized attachment. Mom was either frightening or frightened, and you can't really calm yourself down if you've never been soothed. So they all want in on the 18-month training program because it's a paid gig. And but we always say we're not interested in people who are here for the check, only those who are here for the change. It's about doing the work, working on yourself. So anger management therapy, parenting, all sorts of classes, free tattoo removal. No place on the planet Earth removes more tattoos than we do. We have a designated clinic in our headquarters. We have 3 laser machines, 1 paid physician assistant, but 47 volunteer doctors. 30,000 treatments a year. So if any of you are starting to regret that Columbia tattoo you have, just see me afterwards. And part of the thing about going to the margins is to listening to the folks there, you know, and they'll tell you exactly what you need. In the gospel, there's that dynamic between the approach of Jesus is absolute humility in the face of the poor and those, the widow, orphan, and the stranger. You ask the question, what would help? But as counterposed to hubris in the gospel that says, here's what your problem is. Here's what you need to fix. And so the homies will tell you, or people on the margins will tell you what they need. So tattoo removal was born because of a guy named Frank, who I'd never met him before. 2 days out of Corcoran State Prison, sitting in front of my desk, and his forehead is just blasted, as they say, with this huge tattoo, like a damn billboard, from one end to the next, filling the entire space, and pardon my French, but it said, fuck the world. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I am having a hard time finding a job. And I said, well, Frank, maybe we could put our heads together on this one. So naturally, I hired him, and he begged bread for a while. And then I found a doctor at White Memorial Hospital, a dermatologist who had a laser machine. And I begged him, and he said, okay, I'll give you 1 hour a month. And so he started to chip away at Frank's forehead and a few others. Before too long, I had a waiting list of 3,000 gang members who wanted the same treatment. So parentheses, Frank is currently a security guard at a movie studio in Hollywood, and there is no trace left of the angriest, dumbest thing he had ever done in his life, proving once and for all what Sister Helen Prejean says, that all of us are a whole lot more than the worst things we've ever done. And so we have all our social enterprises. So the trainees go through our phases, the humble phase, you know, where they clean urinals for 3 months, basically. And which is very important, because if you get a big old shot caller gang member, nope, everybody does urinals. It's an important phase. But then they end up in one of all our businesses, the Homeboy Bakery, Homeboy Silkscreen, Homeboy Homegirl Merchandise, where we sell our logo stuff online and in a store. Homeboy, we have a restaurant, Homeboy Cafe, in LAX Terminal 4. Homeboy Diner, the only place you can get food at City Hall in Los Angeles. Farmers Markets. We have a thing called Homeboy Grocery, where we sell chips, salsas, and guacamole in all the Ralph's stores in half the state. They're so good. Thank you very much. What am I missing? We have a new thing, Homeboy Recycling, which is kind of e-waste. That's really done quite well since we have started it just 6 months ago. I'm sure I'm missing. And Homegirl Cafe, where women with records, young ladies from rival gangs, waitresses with attitude, will gladly take your order. And they cater. You know, if you go there, you're going to run into a celebrity or an elected official, because it's kind of a who's who's place. You know, Jim Carrey is there often, pandemonium whenever he is. Jack Black, Forrest Whitaker. The Dodgers came once, and on and on. Once, with only 2 hours' notice from the Secret Service, Vice President Joe Biden, he was vice president at the time, said, I want to eat at the famous Homegirl Cafe. So it was entourage and motorcade and Secret Service and selfies with Uncle Joe. And I wasn't there. I was making my annual 8-day retreat. So when I came back, one of the homies was debriefing me. He said, wow, when you were gone, we were visited by an MVP. an MVP? Do you mean a VIP? That one, VIP. Damn, do you imagine, here at Homeboy Industries, we were visited by the Vice President of the United States, Mick Romney. So I think shortly after that, we started a current affairs class. And I think you can file that one under all white people look alike. Anyway, most famously of all, Diane Keaton showed up, Oscar winner, Godfather movies, Annie Hall. And so her waitress is Glenda. Glenda's a big girl, been there, done that, tattooed, felon, parolee. She has no clue who Diane Keaton is, and so she's taking her order. And Diane Keaton says, well, what do you recommend? And Glenda rattles off the three dishes she particularly likes. And then Diane Keaton says, I'll have that second one. That one sounds really good. And it's at that moment, for some reason, something dawns on Glenda, and she looks at Diane Keaton. She says, wait a minute. I feel like I know you from somewhere. You know, like maybe we've met. And Diane Keaton decides to deflect it humbly. You know, oh, gosh, I suppose I have one of those faces, you know, that people think they've seen before. And Glenda goes, no, now I know. We were locked up together. Well, that just took my breath away when I heard it, and I don't believe we've had any further Diane Keaton sightings now that I think of it. But suddenly, kinship so quickly, Oscar-winning actress, attitudinal waitress, exactly what God had in mind, and we need only listen to Jesus say to the gathered that you may be one. He actually doesn't want it to be about him. He wants it to be about us, that my joy may be yours and your joy complete. That's it. All of us are called to be enlightened witnesses, people who through your kindness and tenderness and focused, attentive love return people to themselves. At Homeboy, we're kind of allergic to the notion of holding the bar up and asking homies to measure up. Our exhausted God never does that to us. Why would we do it to each other? Instead, we just believe in holding the mirror up and telling people the truth, knowing that your truth is my truth, and my truth is a gang member's truth, and it's all the same truth, and here's the truth. You are exactly what God had in mind when God made you. And then you watch folks, especially those on the margins, as they become that truth, as they inhabit that truth, and no bullet can pierce it. No four prison walls can keep it out. And death can't touch it because it's huge. But at Homeboy, we know you have to reach in and you have to dismantle the messages of shame and disgrace that get in the way, that keep people from seeing their truth. Marcus Borg, the late great scripture scholar, used to say that the principal suffering of the poor throughout history and throughout scripture is shame and disgrace. And I think that's quite right. There's an odd kind of sentence in the Acts of the Apostles that says this, and awe came upon everyone. It seems to suggest that the measure of health in any community, including this one, may well reside in our ability to stand in awe at what the poor have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it. So I give some talks. So I'm halfway on the road and halfway in my office with the homies. But I always say yes. And 600 social workers invited me to speak in Richmond, Virginia, and I said yes. You know, and I knew it was an all day gang in the service from 9 to 5, in a hotel ballroom. And, you know, I figured, well, maybe I'll be the keynote, or maybe I'll speak at the beginning, maybe I'll speak at lunch, maybe I'll close the day. I got my ticket. A week before I'm to fly, I pull out the letter, and to my horror, I discover that I am to be the only speaker all damn day from 9 to 5. And I said, oh, hell no. So I called two homies in, Andre and Jose, who were trainees at the time, and I sat them down, gang members, and they were in their 18-month program. And I said, look, you're flying with me to Richmond, Virginia. I'd like you to get up and tell your stories. Take your time. because we got a long-ass day to fill. Well, I'd never heard their stories, and Jose gets up, and he's about 25 years old at the time. And a gang member, felon, been to prison. In his 18-month process, he landed at his last couple months as a very valued member of our substance abuse team, a man solid in his own recovery. Now he's helping younger homies with their addiction issues. And so been to prison. But he also had a long stretch of time as a homeless man and an even longer stretch as a heroin addict. So he gets up in front of 600 social workers and he begins his story and he says, "You know, I guess you could say my mom and me, we didn't get along so good. I think I was 6 when she looked at me and she said, 'Why don't you just kill yourself? You're such a burden to me.'" Well, 600 social workers audibly gasp. And then he says, "It sounds way worser in Spanish." Well, we got whiplash going from gasp to laugh. Then he said, "I think I was 9 when my mom drove me down to the deepest part of Baja California. And she walks me up to an orphanage. And she knocks on the door, and the guy comes to the door, and she says, 'I found this kid. And she left me there for 90 days. Until my grandmother could get out of her where she had dumped me, and my grandmother rescued me. My mom beat me every single day of my elementary school years with things you could imagine and a lot of things you couldn't. Every day my back was bloodied and scarred. In fact, I had to wear 3 t-shirts to school every day. First t-shirt because the blood would seep through. Second t-shirt, you could still see it. Finally, the 3rd t-shirt, you couldn't see any blood. Kids at school, they'd make fun of me. 'Hey, fool, it's 100 degrees. Why are you wearing 3 t-shirts?' Then he stopped speaking, so overwhelmed with emotion. And he seemed to be staring at a piece of his story that only he could see. And when he could regain his speech, he said through his tears, 'I wore 3 t-shirts well into my adult years because I was ashamed of my wounds. I didn't want anybody to see them. But now I welcome my wounds. I run my fingers over my scars. My wounds are my friends. After all, how can I help heal the wounded if I don't welcome my own wounds?'" And awe came upon everyone. The measure of our compassion lies not in our service of those on the margins, but only in our willingness to see ourselves in kinship with them. For the truth of the matter is this: if we don't welcome our own wounds, we may well be tempted to despise the wounded. A few days before Christmas, I buried his mother. And he stood up in front of all these people and he pointed at her ashes and said, "I forgive you." Let me end with this story and then we'll do some questions. Before I do that, I always get this question. You know, once I was in Sydney, Australia, and they were question and answer, and And somebody said, when do you introduce Christ to the gang member? I said, never and immediately. And I believe in that. Once a woman who, after hearing one of my talks, she said, oh yeah, your stories are well and good. She says, you know, you're about to get whacked. And she said, but the only question worth asking is, do you bring Christ to gang members? And I said, no, they bring me to Christ. Once I was interviewed on the Christian Broadcasting Network and by this lady, and she asked me what we do at Homeboy, and I told her everything I told you. I probably cleaned up that one, but and I went on and on. Finally, she looked at me and she said, yeah, but how much time do you spend each day at Homeboy, you know, praising God? And I didn't know what to say, so I said, all damn day. I don't think she liked that answer very much. But I believe it, because I think it's worth asking, what kind of praise does our God have any interest in? So it occurs to people who, universities in particular, to force their students to read my book against their will. I'm not complaining, but my alma mater, Gonzaga University in Spokane, I was invited because they forced the freshmen, incoming freshmen, to read the book. And they said, please come, we're going to have a big venue, like 2,000 people, Tuesday night. And I said, sure. And they said, oh, by the way, could you bring two homies with you? And I do whenever somebody says, please bring them with you, and they're going to pay for it. And I always pick homies the same way. You know, I pick enemies, rivals, guys, trainees who are from different rival enemy gangs, just so they have to share a hotel room just to mess with them, you know. And I always pick homies who have never flown before just for the thrill of seeing gang members panicked in the sky. Not that long ago, I had two older vatos. We were at LAX, and we were going to D.C. And the guy said, hey, are we flying Virgin Airlines because it's our first time? I said, well, yes, it's a requirement. We'll be coming home on American. So I picked these two homies, Mario and who worked in our merchandise store at the time, and Bobby, an African American gang member, worked in the bakery. And I've done this so many times, hundreds of times, maybe thousands, I don't know, with men and women. And I've never taken anybody like this guy Mario, who was absolutely petrified of flying. I've never seen anything quite like it. In fact, he was hyperventilating. And we hadn't even boarded the plane. And so we're at Burbank Airport, which is a small airport, and big bay windows, Southwest Airlines, big planes. But they don't have that hermetically sealed chute you get onto board. You have to walk out onto the tarmac like you're the president, and you climb up the steps on the front of the plane, and the big feature at Burbank are the steps at the back of the plane. So I'm sitting there with Mario. Bobby's off somewhere, and our plane arrives. It's early morning, and I said, that's our plane. And I think, oh, my God, he may die before we actually climb up those stairs. And so our flight crew arrives, and I see two flight attendants, females, and they both have very large cups of Starbucks coffee, and they're schlepping up the front steps to get on the plane. And Mario goes, when are we going to board the plane? And I said, as soon as they sober up the pilots, there they go now. Perhaps I shouldn't have said that. So I should tell you that in the history, 30-year history of Homeboy, nobody has more tattoos on him than Mario. I mean, he's all sleeved out, head shaved, covered in tattoos. forehead, cheeks, chin, neck blackened with the name of his gang. He closes his eyes and it says, "The end." And I'd never been in public with him, so at one point I'm trying to calm him down, and we're walking through the airport, and people are like this, you know, and mothers are clutching their kids a little more closely, and I'm thinking, wow, that's interesting, because if you were to go to Homeboy on Monday and ask anybody there, who's the kindest, most gentle, tender soul who works here, they won't say me. They'll say, Mario. Yeah, Mario. He now sells baked goods over the counter at our bakery. Kindest, most gentle soul. He is, in fact, proof that only the soul that ventilates the world with tenderness has any chance of changing the world. So we get to Gonzaga, and this always happens everywhere. They'll say, you have the big 2,000 people Tuesday night talk. What they don't tell you is they got 93 other talks that they have, you know, like this class, this meeting, this lunch, this class, all damn day. So I tell Mario and Bobby, look, I'm not going to speak at any of these. I want you two to get up. I'll sit in the back of the class. And they're nervous, especially Mario, but they do a good job. Stories of terror and torture and violence. Honest to God, if their stories had been flames, you'd have to keep your distance. Otherwise, you'd get scorched. Stories of abuse of every imaginable kind. I would not have survived a day of their childhoods. So the nighttime talk came, and I kind of threw him a curveball. I said, look, I hadn't planned on doing this. I do this all the time now, but I said, look, I want you guys to get up before me in front of 2,000 people. Do a little snapshot, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, tell your story, so that I can include you in the question and answer at the end. And they were terrified, especially Mario, but again, they did a good job. So I did my thing, and then I invite them up, and, yeah, let's just throw it open. Yes, ma'am. And so a woman stands, and she goes, yeah, I got a question. It's for Mario. First question out the gates for Mario. He's this tall, skinny drink of water, and he clutches the microphone. Yes. And he's terrified. And she goes, well, you say you're a father, and you have a son and a daughter. They're about to enter their teenage years. What wisdom do you impart to them? You know, what advice do you give them? And Mario closes his eyes, and he clutches the microphone, and he's trembling, and I can feel the emotions are rising. And he's getting a damn hernia trying to come up with whatever the hell he's going to say when suddenly he blurts out, I just... As soon as he says those two words, he retreats back to his microphone-clutching, closed-eyed retreat. And now I know he's losing his battle with his tears, and he's just trembling. But he wants to get this sentence out. I just don't want my kids to turn out to be like me. And there's silence until the woman who asked the question stands, and now it's her turn to cry. Why wouldn't you want your kids to turn out to be like you? You are loving. You are kind. You are gentle. You are wise. I hope your kids turn out to be like you. And 2,000 total perfect strangers stand, and they will not stop clapping. And all Mario can do is hold his face in his hands, so overwhelmed with emotion that this room full of strangers had decided to return him to himself. And of course, they were returned to themselves as well, which shouldn't surprise us, because it's mutual. And I think that's the only praise our exhausted God has any interest in. That you may be one. My joy yours, your joy complete. And so we go to the margins. And we create a community of kinship such that God, in fact, might recognize it. And we brace ourselves, or rather, we cease to care anymore if people accuse us of wasting our time. For in this place of which you say it is a waste, there will be heard again the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voices of those who sing. We don't go to the margins to make a difference, but so that those voices might get heard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Father Greg. I think I'll propose maybe 30 seconds to a minute of being able to stretch our legs just a little bit. Hope you won't leave the room because that'll create a lot of chaos if you're coming back in. But what I'm going to do is just we're going to adjust our chairs so Father Greg can have a chance to sit down and we'll have some questions and answers. So you got about 30 seconds to kind of stretch out a little bit if you need to sort of get that set up.
Or, they're trying to get their kids back so they go to parenting. So there's NAAA. We have a thing called CGA, which is called Criminals and Gangs Anonymous, which was born in Mill Creek State Prison in California. And it's kind of for gang members who say, drugs have never been my thing, but I was addicted to the lifestyle of gang banging, basically. So we have so many things, but in order to get into the 18-month program, you have to test clean. So it's drug test. Then the next week, if you're clean, you come for orientation where we explain who we are. And then the following week, they have an interview. It's called selection committee. I'm never on that. It's always just the homies. And so anyone who says, I just want a job, probably won't be brought in. But we're kind of reverse cherry pickers. It's like if you're really belligerent and a knucklehead, you're going to be selected, Because the idea is you want to have an impact on public safety. And so so we say at Homeboy, an employed inmate or gang member may or may not return to prison. Or an educated one may or may not return to prison. But a healed gang member won't ever go back to prison. That's our guarantee. And because it's about healing, it's not about behavior modification. You want to get underneath the behavior. What is violence telling you? What language is it speaking? It's the language of despondent people and damaged people and mentally ill people. And so let's heal what's going on there. And so that's kind of the process.
And you talked about that a little bit in your books, like why is it that people join gangs? And I know that's a question that comes up, or people sometimes have some tension with the answers that they're provided to that. But tell us a little bit about your experience of that.
So I was somewhere in some major city where a chief of police was handing me this brochure. And it's one of those brochures that you hand to parents. And what are the telltale signs that your kid is gravitating perilously close to possible gang involvement? And we give this to parents just so they can help their kids make better choices. And I remember thinking, not all choices are created equal. I grew up in L.A., the gang capital of the world, but I won all these lotteries, the parent lottery, the zip code lottery, the education lottery, the sibling lottery. Not true, those who grew up in the community where I've lived for the last 33 years. So he handed me the brochure, and inside it says the number one reason why kids join gangs, writ large, was excitement. And I remember thinking at the time, I didn't want to diss his brochure, you know, but I thought, you know, if I compiled a list of 200 reasons why kids join gangs, excitement wouldn't appear on my list, you know. But that's the outsider view driving the inside of our policy. That's outsiders going, oh, okay, put this down. Here's why kids join gangs. Excitement. That's how that exactly arrived in that brochure. And there's only three profiles of kids who join gangs. There's the despondent kid who can't imagine a future, so he plans his funeral. If you can't see your future, your present isn't compelling. And if your present doesn't compel you, you won't care whether you inflict harm. You won't care whether you duck to get out of harm's way. The second profile of the kid who joins a gang is the damaged kid, the traumatized kid, who can't see his way clear to transform his pain, so he just keeps transmitting it. And then the third profile of the kid who joins the gang is the mentally ill kid. And all of these are on a continuum of severity. Some are more despondent than mentally ill. Some are more traumatized than despondent. But if we believe that to be the correct diagnosis, we would infuse hope to kids for whom hope is foreign. And we would help heal the kid who is damaged. And we would deliver mental health services in a timely and culturally appropriate way. But no healthy treatment plan has ever been born of a bad diagnosis. I don't think ever. So you want to get the diagnosis right so that you can deliver through relationship. That's the only delivery system I know for those three things. You know, healing and hope and mental health services. So if you're the proud owner of a Pulse, I'll give you a moment to check, then you can be a beneficial presence. Part of the problem is we're always disqualifying ourselves. You know, I'm not a gang member. I don't have tattoos. I've never been to prison. Nonsense. This is a human thing.
So one of the questions that we got fairly frequently from folks around our church community was, what are some of the practices that you do? You know, you mentioned a whole host of ideas that are a common part of, like, spiritual formation. So being present, finding joy. And you also talk about there's no recipes for trying to live in a way that allows this kind of ministry to take place. But there must be some practices you've engaged in over the years that help you maintain that posture and presence in the midst of all that you see and do. What are the practices that inform that?
Well, you know, I think what's the secret sauce? You know, so if you go around the country as I do, and let's face it, everybody has the same menu of services. Anger management, therapy, you know, GED. We do that, they do that, everybody does that. But what's the secret sauce? You know, how do you keep from becoming the DMV? You know? apparently half this room works at the DMV. I am sorry. But, you know, it's sort of like, so what do you need? Anger management? Go to window 48. Yes, what do you need? That kind of thing. So we do this, all those services, but the difference is it's a community of tenderness. So I know in Pacific Northwest, the LARCH communities are quite present. And Jean Vanier, a great saint who started over half a century ago, he says that the highest form of maturity in spirituality is tenderness. And so I think that's kind of the secret sauce. So homies show up every day, not because it's not for the check. You know, you walk into the room, tour groups, and people will say, wow, what is this? Not what are you doing here? What is this? They feel it. It's palpable. It's tenderness. It's relational wholeness. And so you want to be anchored in that. And it's the only thing that can heal ultimately. And so homies start to re-identify who they are in the world. You know, I used to think courage meant holding a gun. Now I know that has nothing to do with it. This is why we changed who we were somewhere about 10 years in, because we were just dispatching gang members to jobs, finding employers willing to bring them in. But then the monkey wrench would get tossed into this guy's life, and his lady leaves him, and he's immediately back gangbanging, and now he's doing 125 years to life in Folsom Prison. And we started to scratch our heads and say, what's that about? Well, there was no healing. There was no resilience. He didn't know the truth of who he was. Now they leave us after 18 months, and the world will throw at them what it will. But this time, they won't be toppled because they know who they are. And you can kind of take that to the bank. Now, understanding that healing ends in the graveyard for every one of us. But there is a kind of, we call it, essential foundational healing. If they cooperate and meet you halfway, 18 months will do it. And it's intensive and it's therapeutic. But I invite you to go there sometime because it's quite extraordinary. And it has this life of its own, quite apart from anything I've ever done. And it's just really palpable. And so that's the thing that makes it, I think.
How do you help yourself, like in your own ministry, as well as if we were looking beyond the gang members themselves and people seeking to minister in the community, how do they increase their capacity for compassion and tenderness? Are there things that have helped you do that in your ministry over the years?
Well, it's all about being anchored in the present moment. Otherwise, this is a truism, but otherwise you're lamenting whatever you did yesterday, or you're fretting about what's going to happen tomorrow, and so you've lost the present moment. We're only saved in the present moment, period. And so the more you can stay anchored in the present moment, and as long as it's about being reached by folks at the margin rather than reaching them. You know, a woman came once, we have 300 volunteers, and she says, I have to volunteer at Homeboy Industries. I said, why do you have to volunteer at Homeboy Industries? She said, I believe I have a message these young people need to hear. I said, yikes. I said, do me a favor, the second you lose that message, I hope you come back to us. Because I don't want your damn message. You know, you want people to come in and just say, I'm the most selfish person alive. I want to come here because I want folks at the margins to make me different. And then what happens is folks on the margins with you in this exquisite mutuality, everybody's inhabiting their nobility and their truth. And it's magnificent because it's mutual. And there is no daylight that separates you. So my staff, you know, my senior staff, which is about 85 people, and then we have CORE, which are the homies who have sort of graduated from the program, but we think they kind of, hey, you're a good baker. Why don't you stick around and maybe help the new batch? And then we have the trainees. And but my senior staff, you know, when they get depleted, I said, you know, you're doing it wrong if you're depleted. You can be exhausted, then you're imitating the God we actually have. But if you're depleted, it's about you. So all the kind of compassion fatigue and, you know, people won't agree with me on this, but I think if you're delighting in the person in front of you and you're anchored in the present moment and you know that you're being saved in this moment, that the Christ in you is recognizing the Christ in him, you won't ever be depleted. You'll be tired. You'll be wiped out. But you won't be depleted. And that's why people burn out, is because they think their job is to save people. And it isn't. Because then it's about you and you'll burn out.
So one of the things you talk about in the second book that you've got, Bark Into the Choir, is that the homies have to have sort of lesser versions of themselves die. And one of the questions that that came up for me is along the way, as you've engaged this ministry and watched people engage in this ministry, what sort of versions of you as you started this have had to pass away in order for this to kind of come about?
Oh, that's, you know, like in my first book, I have a story, which I'm not going to tell the whole story, but it's the light switch story where the kid has a dream and we're in a dark room in the dream and we're not speaking. And his brother had just killed himself, a gang member also. Anyway, the dream was, I pull out a flashlight and I aim it at the light switch. And I don't say a word. And this kid, Lulu, I'm losing my microphone again. Lulu says in the dream, he knows that he's the only one who can turn the light switch on. He's glad that I happen to have a flashlight. So he goes and he turns the light switch on. And
hey, Dave, we'll just go to the cord one. Just go to this one.
Yeah. And then,
hold on, give him one second. Dave's fast, but he's not that fast.
And then a little more juice. And then, yeah.
There you go.
And he goes to the light switch, and the room is flooded with light, and he's sobbing as he's telling me this dream. And he says, the light is better than the darkness. Like he didn't know this to be the case. That dream changed my life. I let go at that moment. That was 6 years. That was 10 years in. I let go of this notion of, oh, I've been trying to turn the light switch on for people. And I stopped doing it. Period. Cold turkey. And that changed my life forever. I mean, I have a lot of those. But that was one that was dramatic. And I said, oh, I've been doing it wrong. Just clear. And I stopped doing it. And I realized that no amount of me wanting him to have a life will ever be the same as him wanting to have one. And so owning a flashlight, knowing where to aim it, that has to be enough for us.
One of the questions that came through online was, what's the most common piece of sort of criticism or pushback that you get? What is that? And then how do you process that as you go along, or have you learned to process that?
Well, you know, so we've been around for 30 years, 88 to 18. And so for the first 10 years were death threats, bomb threats, and hate mail. Never from gang members, but from folks who had thoroughly demonized gang members. So the friend of our enemy is our enemy. So if I helped gang members and society demonized them, it's a short hop to demonize me. So we used to get... And a lot of times from law enforcement, odd, unsigned, but I'm an LAPD or I'm a sheriff. We hate you. We think you're part of the problem. Because they had so wholly demonized this population that it was an untenable kind of situation. So I suppose that was hard in the beginning, but I don't know. You know, you don't take stuff personally. And in the same way that gang violence is a symptom, it's an indicator, it points beyond itself. The same way the hatred of people hating Homeboy was a symptom. So none of that seems to be present now, you know. It's hard to even retrieve those days. But the thing is, you want to be anchored. You want to go, this is... And everybody, funders in particular, you know, we don't fund efforts. We fund... What's the word? Outcomes. And I don't care about outcomes. I don't. Is it good and true and just and right? Then do that. And outcomes, you know, who cares? And who knows, you know? You're never going to tell me that Homeboy's not successful. Prove it. Oh, I don't care. I don't care. Give us money, don't give us money. Good and true and just and right. That's what we're going to do. That's how I always tell my staff. You know, otherwise, if you shift and go, no, we need outcomes, we're going to try to get outcomes, then you're going to stop working with the people you started to work with. Somebody the other day said, I'd like you to introduce me to some funder.
our program that's been around now for 5 years, 100% of our population don't go back to prison. I said, well, of course they don't. You only work with people who won't go back to prison. You know, and with all due respect, you know. But once you chase outcomes, then you're going to only work with people who will give you good ones. And that just doesn't feel like where the gospel would have us stand. How about one last one?
Yeah, one last one. So one of the ones that as I read the books, the questions I had is how do you maintain relational capacity? So there's a sense when you read through the books that homies come in sort of plopping themselves down in front of you on a regular basis. And how does that work given the fact that you're the face of a pretty large organization? I think that's a question both related to Homeboy, but I think all of us have times where we're trying to figure out how to balance maybe what it is we would like to do with the ability to be available and present for those that we love, whether it's in a ministry setting or a home setting. How have you intentionally gone about maintaining sort of relational bandwidth for the homies that want to come through the door and plop themselves down in your chair? I mean, I ask this question as minister regularly with the students that I work with. How have you intentionally gone about that?
Well, you know, and less is more. You know, you think you have to go, I'm going to spend 3 hours with you. No, I haven't done that in 25 years. And, you know, you just can't afford to do it. You know, you don't want to become, you know, now serving number 49. You know, but that's why the texting is so important. I make fun of it. But I'm constantly doing it. And then I get so many of them. And sometimes I do texting roulette where I just go through and I'll go, oh, Louie, hey, how's that? Is the baby sleeping through the night? Oh, my God, you have no idea. That one sentence, they'll be weeping that suddenly they came to mind. I learned a homegirl named Jeanette who works there. She came in and she needed to tell me this. It just breaks my heart. And she says, you know, I texted you a couple days ago, and I don't want you to take this the wrong way. Just say anything. Got it, kiddo. Okay. Because when you don't answer, I think you're mad at me. And it just broke me in heart, my heart in two. And so I do it. I'm constantly, you know. I was at a Catholic church waiting to speak to 700 high school confirmation class or something. I don't know what it was. And I was over here. I was being introduced, and I was going. It was the day Jeanette had said that to me. And I'm going, I got to get through like five more texts. Okay, I got you. Okay, Michael. I love you so much. Oh, you're the best. I'm really proud of you. Ooh, if you were my son, I would have thought I won the lottery. Send, 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 send. Afterwards, a woman was so incensed at me. And she said, well, the cell phone. I go, the bit about the cell phone? No. You were texting in front of the tabernacle. I said, wow. It wasn't my finest moment because I reached over and I said, aren't we lucky that we have a God who doesn't give two toots about that? But I wasn't proud of it because it was like, why do you have to win the argument? You know? So, but anyway, I'm going to end with one last story because I don't want to end on me being a doofus. So, plopping down in my office. So, they try to, then they'll text me, they're in the building, I need to talk to you today. You know, and so some homie named Danny, and there are certain kids who you think are never going to kind of turn the ship around, you know, and this kid Danny was one of them. And I met him when he was 13, and he was a little knucklehead, really into his neighborhood, packing a gun all the time, did dirt for his neighborhood. And once he vowed to me, I will never step foot in Homeboy Industries. And I said, well, okay. So I'd see him in the barrio. I'd see him in the alley where they kicked it. And I'd see him in juvenile hall. I'd see him in probation camp, detention facilities, youth authority. Finally, he went to prison at 18. Only did a 2-year stretch. And in recovery, they say it takes what it takes. You know, it can be the death of a friend, birth of a son, long stretch in prison. For Danny, he came out of prison at 20. And to discover that his mother had 6 months to live, she had pancreatic cancer. So I watched him there. He became, out of a large family, he was the hospice point person. And he was so tender with her. Again, all the more remarkable because this woman really did torture this kid. Torture. I'm going to presume mental illness. But there he was. So tender. Till the end. And she died. A week later, I buried her. A week after that, he walks into Homeboy Industries for the first time in all the years that I knew him. So I watch him, you know, laughing with guys I know he used to shoot at because I know these things. I watch him get his GED, and now he's taking courses at East LA Community College. So one day he comes in and he sits down and he's demanded an audience with me and he says, "What happened yesterday has never happened to me in my life." So he tells me that he gets on the Gold Line Chinatown stop, which is across the street from us, and he's taking it east to go home. And it's a packed train, but he gets a seat. Standing right in front of him, he says, holding onto a pole, is what he says, a medio pedo guy, a guy who's a little bit drunk. He's a homie because he can see that he has tattoos on his hand. Older guy, he says, he doesn't know who he is. And the guy who's a little bit drunk sees Danny, and Danny has a sweatshirt that says Homeboy Industries, Jobs, Not Jails, but it fills his whole chest. And the guy says, "You work there?" And Danny doesn't know whether to engage him or not, and he nods. "Is it any good?" And Danny shrugs and he says, "Well, it's helped me. In fact, I don't think I'll ever go back to prison because of this place." So then Danny stands and he fishes into his pocket a piece of paper and he has a pen. And he writes the address of Homeboy Industries on the piece of paper. And as he's telling me the story, he says, "I couldn't believe I knew the address by heart." And he hands the paper to the guy and he says, "You come see us. We'll help you." And the guy studies the piece of paper and he says, "Thank you." And the train stops and the guy gets off. And Danny says to me with great emotion, "What happened to me next has never happened to me in my life." Everyone on the train was looking at me. Everyone on the train was nodding at me. Everyone on the train was smiling at me. And now he can barely speak, and I have to wait for him. And for the first time in my life, I felt admired. And the two of us wept. Because in the end, what do you say? You don't have to say anything. Weeping will do. Thank you very much.
Is that what you're like? Do you want me to tell them that or not? Okay, then you'll be in the back someplace? Okay. Thank you so much.
Let me get that.
Yeah, exactly. Go for it. I'll stall with this. So thank you all again so much for coming. Father Greg will be at the back for a little bit. He's willing to sign some books and things. There are some very light refreshments out there that are available to you if you want them. You're welcome to stay and mingle and chat and ask questions. But thank you all so much for coming. We hope you feel welcome, and God bless you.